Okay, so a while ago, I worked as the junior foreign service officer at the Malaysian embassy, right? And one day, one of the embassy staff, Ravi, he was assigned the job of introducing me to some bigwigs at the Malaysian Congress. And of course, this made Ravi angry, because he had better things to do. So before we left, Ravi looked me in the eye. Glenn, this is serious. These are very important people. None of your fooling about. My man, don't worry. I'm cool. Do not worry. We get down to the Parliament building, and Ravi knows exactly what he's doing. We march down one hall, up some stairs, past the side room, and he opens an unmarked door. It's a special, fancy lunchroom for the Muckety Mucks. We walk in, fancy china, bow-tied waiters, and seated there, right at the door, is the Deputy Prime Minister himself, the man destined to seize the reins of power any moment. Anwar Ibrahim, the prince in waiting. And surrounded by 10, 15 brown nosers. And Robbie's like, do not look him in the eye. So I do not look him in the eye. I try to be cool and saunter by, but the prince holds out his hand, stops me, reads my name tag. Washington. You're from the American Embassy. And he's talking to me, and I'm nervous. Yes, my liege, my deputy, Mr. Prime Minister, sir. And like he knows me, Anwar goes on about the Jackson family and Haruki Murakami books and fish and chips and paintball. And pretty soon, it's like we're old friends, laughing and talking. And he says we should go sing karaoke. And I'm starting to get real comfortable, right? And I'm like, hey, Mr. Deputy Prime Minister, I saw in the paper that you won second prize in a coconut husking contest this morning. Correct. Second prize? Well, has the first prize winner been beheaded yet? All the laughing stops. The brown nosers grimace. Even the waiters don't make a sound. Ravi shoots daggers at me. I can hear his thoughts in my head. I told you. The Deputy Prime Minister looks at me for a moment. Hard. Slow motion hard. And he rocks his head back and starts laughing. Then the brown nosers start laughing, and the room starts laughing, and I start laughing. But Ravi's not laughing. And when we leave, he gets all up in my face. I can see the inside of his nostrils. He says, in the presence of a scorpion, never sleep. Today on Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, we proudly present The Crown. Stories where regular people, people like you and me, bump up against the most exalted class of all, royalty. Yes, heavy is the head that wears the crown. My name is Glenn Washington, and this is Snap Judgment. Now then, some of us know more about their past than others. Sarah Jane Culberson understood that she was born to a black father and a white mother, and adopted by a loving white family. And really, that's just about all she knew.
I was adopted right before my first birthday by Dr. Jim and Judy Culberson, my parents. When I was growing up, I had a lot of questions, not looking like my family and having this big curly afro and trying to fit in. How old was I when I first started to look into finding my birth family? You know, I started thinking about it my senior year of high school. I found out that my birth mother passed away of cancer when I would have been about 11 years old. think at first I thought that my biological father had abandoned my birth mother. I was angry. I thought, well, what'd you do? Just meet a white woman in the 70s and take off? Didn't you care about me? Didn't you love me? I realized what was really going on is that I was really afraid of finding him. Then I said to myself, you know what? I don't want to be 60, 70, or 80 someday, and it's too late to find him because he's gotten older and he's passed away. So why don't I just, you know, take a risk and try to find him? So I called the private investigator, and I got all the information I needed within 3 hours. I wrote a letter to Maryland, which is where they said my birth father was. And I rewrote the letter, trying to make it just perfect, mailed it off to Maryland. I was really nervous. Maybe he's not alive. Maybe he'll say, you know, I never wanted to meet you. That's why I wasn't there. Maybe he's in jail. 4 days later, I got a phone call. And I pick up the phone. I'll never forget this day. I was at my apartment, and there was this woman on the other line. She said,
"Hello, Sarah. This is Evelyn. How are you? I'm your auntie. We received your letter."
And then my uncle gets on the phone, and he says,
"Oh, Sarah, we are so happy you have been found. You know who you are."
And I'm like, "I'm Sarah."
"You are part of a royal family. You are considered a princess in this country. In Sierra Leone, your grandfather was a paramount chief. Your uncle is now the paramount chief and runs a chiefdom of 36,000 people. You can be chief someday if you ever choose to."
I was in shock. I was thinking, okay, well, I just, you know, I wanted to just see a picture. I wasn't expecting to hear, oh, you're part of this royal family and you're considered a princess in this country. I was, what? Like, wait a second. Hearing this, do I have to be perfect now? Do I need to wear dresses all the time? Am I never allowed to say a bad word accidentally? I mean, how am I supposed to be? Because I've known myself. I'm Sarah in Los Angeles. Now what? I went on to learn more about what that means. Mahaloi, which is the daughter of a paramount chief with the status of a princess. Like, I said, well, what does that mean? My uncle said, well, our family has a lot of responsibility in the country, specifically in the Bumpe chiefdom. I wasn't very familiar with Sierra Leone. I didn't know about the civil war that went on in that country from 1991 to 2002. I didn't know about the blood diamonds and many people dying over diamonds during a war. My uncle said, I'm your father's brother. We'll contact him. So they got a message from one village to the next, that then got my father the message. And he called after 2 weeks. The first thing he said is he said, please forgive me. He said, I didn't know how to find you after you'd been put up for adoption. Your name had changed. Everything had changed. And I said, no, wait a second. Please forgive me. Because I've been making you wrong my entire life just to protect myself. And I'm not going to do that anymore. And he said, okay. And I said, how do I get to meet you? I'd love to meet you. I'd love to see you. We planned a trip for 6 months later. Why did I go to Sierra Leone? I guess maybe selfish reasons. In some ways, I wanted to know who I looked like. I wanted to see my father. I did not go to Sierra Leone with any thoughts of being a princess. I met my father at the airport in Sierra Leone, and he was so nervous to meet me, and I was so nervous to meet him, and we just gave each other big hugs. He said, it's so good to finally meet you. And I said, it's so good to finally meet you too. And he took my hand and he gave me a green African dress to wear into the village, and he had a matching green shirt on. We traveled on these, I call them Indiana Jones roads, these bumpy roads to Bumpe. After the war, the roads were really bad. And as we drove up the hill, after about 6 hours of driving and exhaustion, there were these kids who started to run alongside the car wearing all white. and they were cheering. Then as we drove up a little more, I saw hundreds of people singing and dancing, cheering, welcoming me, and all of a sudden everyone parted and all the women of the village came forward wearing the same green dress that I had been given that morning. And they were singing, put a tang, 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 put a tang, 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 pa do a do way, puta said a go to. They were singing, "We're preparing for Sarah," and I had never met anyone there in my entire life. I didn't feel like it was real. Like, why is there such a big celebration? They took me to a big circle, and there was singing and dancing and drumming. My uncle said, "Our daughter has come home, and she can be chief someday if she ever chooses to." There was one thing to hear that on the phone with my uncle. You know, there's another thing to hear it in front of hundreds of people. It was a little, oh gosh, what does that mean? And what I mean by that is it's a huge responsibility. There are problems. He has 10 section chiefs underneath him that report to him from each section of the chiefdom. From my understanding, there are close to 50,000 people in this chiefdom. And my first thought was, there's no way that I could do something like that. And I'm just being honest. My first instinct was, this is a community that I didn't grow up in. I grew up in America, and this is huge. And you're chief until you die. It's not like a 4-year term or something like that. You're chief until you die. And you actually sleep in this house that's built in one day. It's a small little kind of round hut that's white and stucco. It's not glamorous at all. I, as I mentioned, went there for myself. And as I was there, I saw what happened after an 11-year civil war. People had had their hands cut off. On the second day, my father took us to see Bumpe High School, which was used as a barracks for the rebels. The roof had been ripped off. All the books were gone and had been set on fire. When I was in the bombed out school, I realized the reality of, okay, the kids are sitting on the floor. It was a huge wake up call. For myself, the definition that I came to was, being a princess was being responsible. I realized, you know, we've got to do something. We decided to just start with education, to just get the school up and going. And that's not something that I thought I'd be doing in this lifetime. My thought was, okay, I'm going to be an actress, do TV and film. Having a foundation doing work in West Africa was not part of any plan. And taking my parents to Sierra Leone, which is something that I did in 2007, and my dad and my birth father worked together and got $50,000 to build 9 wells that are serving 12,000 people right now. I used to think for years that my father, my birth father, didn't want to have anything to do with me. I came to find out that that wasn't the truth. My father is not irresponsible at all. He's extremely responsible. And I think that was one of his responsibilities to go back to Sierra Leone. One of the things that he was committed to go back and support the community. And that's what my grandfather and my great-grandfather did. That's what I'm committed to doing.
Find out more about Sarah's story, a link to her book, and the amazing Passawa Foundation on our website, snapjudgment.org. That piece was produced by Anna Sussman with sound design by Renzo Gorio. You're listening to Snap Judgment, the Crown episode. And when we return, the king wears no clothes. Snap finds a spirit guide and reconstructed jail built entirely of money. When Snap Judgment continues, don't go anywhere. You're not going anywhere. Snap Judgment. ¶¶
Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the crown episode, where today we take you behind the veil to glimpse a world the average person knows nothing about. Now, Jane Amelia Larson was an actress and producer living in Los Angeles. And when money got tight, she started looking around for a few extra ways to make some cash.
I had some friends that were chauffeurs. You can make a lot of money. You can make really good tips. I thought, I'm going to do this. I knew a guy who was driving, and he was arranging a detail for a Saudi family that was coming to town, a Saudi royal family. They wanted one female driver in particular to drive a young teenage princess. I had heard rumors that the Saudi royals tip really well if they're happy with what you do. It was a family of seven with an entourage of over 40. And that entourage included massage therapists, trainers, cooks, servants. The Saudi royals were vacationing in Beverly Hills. Whenever people come into town, into Beverly Hills, they love to shop. The Saudis just cleaned out the shops, cleaned them out. We went to Chanel and to Hermes and to Tiffany's. Hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of shopping a day. It was astounding. And what I found also remarkable is that I never saw any of the royals handle any cash, actually. And the servants paid for everything. The Saudis would just choose what they liked, leave the store, and go to the next store. And then the servants would scurry to pay for everything and grab the bags and throw them into a van at the back of the limo line. At the time, I was so broke, and I was so happy to have a job, that I didn't think about the comparison between my condition and theirs. But as time went on, once I was working 16 or 18 hours a day, I got mad because I thought, you know, here are these people with billions and billions of dollars that don't even think about what they're spending, that don't have any idea, it doesn't even come into their consciousness. One of the princesses that I was assigned to drive, and I ended up driving for quite a while, was Princess Rajiya, and she was a young teenager. She had her own personal maidservant, so that when she walked into the hotel, she would just drop all her clothing as she was taking it off, because there were maids to pick it up. She didn't do anything for herself. She didn't do anything. Now, at first, she didn't look at me or talk to me at all. Because remember, she's a Saudi royal. And I was a lowly chauffeur, and I was constantly reminded of that. As I spent more time with this young princess, she started to clock everything that I said and did. And she noticed that I had a stash of power bars in the glove compartment. And she was curious about them, and she wanted to see what they were like. So I drove her to Whole Foods with her nanny. She started to choose boxes of the power bars, a whole box of one, a whole box of another, a whole box of another. To buy just one of them loose like that was very unprincess-like. We ended up buying hundreds of dollars worth of power bars. As I said before, I never saw any of the Saudis touch money ever. So the nanny took it upon herself to teach the young princess how to use cash. So what the princess did, after all the power bars were tallied, she threw down several $100 bills, and then she just walked away and didn't wait for the change. And the cashier just was kind of stunned for a second and then said, "Excuse me, miss, there's change for you." And once the princess realized that she hadn't handled the transaction correctly, she was totally mortified. It was so painful to watch. She got so red in the face and so embarrassed. I really felt for her in that moment because she was making a lot of effort to show that she could be just like any other American teenager. But, you know, she couldn't really. There is this seemingly endless cash to do anything you want. But, you know, they couldn't do anything they want. They led very carefully circumscribed lives. There was one young princess that I drove who was maybe 17 or 18 years old. Her name was Princess Soraya. She was a lovely girl, very pretty, very sweet. And she had come from a summer course at Berkeley, and she had been thrilled to be actually studying there. And as soon as she got in the car, she told me that she wanted to go see UCLA. And as we drove through the UCLA campus, she got very excited and also very sad at the same time. What was unusual about her is this was the first conversation that I had with any of the Saudi royals about anything of an intellectual nature, and she told me that she had taken a course in the writings of Ralph Waldo Emerson. She had been thinking on Emerson's ideas that we all aspire to be part of the same God. And then she told me that she had begged her father to stay here to study at UCLA, and that she was not being allowed to stay because she was being sent home to be married. She was going to be the third wife of a colleague of her father's, and she was told that he was very kind. I was very touched by her bravery, by her loyalty to her family, by her insistence that she was looking forward to making her family proud, to making her family happy, that was her duty. I just admired the heck out of her. I spent the whole afternoon with her, and at the end of the day, she wanted very much to go to the beach. We parked along the Pacific Coast Highway, and we just watched the waves, and we watched the surfers, actually. It was really beautiful because they were silhouetted against the sun. And after a while, I said, "Don't you want to get out of the car? Don't you want to walk along the water or put your toes in the sand?" And she said, "No. No, thank you. I will just look. Thank you." What she did was sat in silence and sobbed as she powered the window up and down, up and down, up and down, until she had composed herself, until I felt that we were ready to move on.
Thank you, Jane Amelia Larson, for sharing that story with Snap. Find out more about Jane's time with the Saudi princesses and a link to her book, DrivingTheSaudis.com, on our website, snapjudgment.org. That piece was produced by Anna Sussman with sound design by Julia DeWitt. Today, on The Crown, we're diving into stories that touch on royalty. And your regular duke, earl, and baron, that's all well and good. But our next piece bumps up against the King of Kings, the Prince of Peace, and the Lord of Lords. Take it away, Stephanie Fu.
In 1954, an article was published in Harper's Magazine. In it was a story about two women in a sanitarium who both believed they were the Virgin Mary. The patients were placed in the same ward, and after some time living together, one of the patients realized that since they couldn't both be Mary, maybe she wasn't Mary after all. She snapped out of her delusion. And shortly thereafter, she was discharged from the hospital. Milton Rokic read this article and thought, I've got to try this myself. Rokic was a highly respected chain-smoking psychologist with a no-nonsense attitude, but he was also known to go the extra mile to help his students and colleagues. And this story about the two Marys, it got him thinking about how we construct our own identities. Why do we think we are who we think we are? And how could he use this information to help schizophrenics? To figure this out, in 1959, Dr. Rokic found three schizophrenic men in Michigan who believed they were Jesus Christ. Rokic brought them together to live at the Ypsilanti State Mental Hospital. He called them the Three Christs. Rokic is no longer alive to tell his story, but his graduate students, the ones who helped him orchestrate this experiment, are. This is Ron.
I'm Ron Hoppe.
And Dick.
My name is Richard Bonnier.
Do you remember meeting the Three Christs for the first time?
Yes, I do. I was a little apprehensive because I had no experience really with working or, quote, living with chronically ill people.
We all brought into a room and the three of us met the three of them.
The oldest was Clyde. He was also the farthest gone. At 70, he was pretty senile, and he'd also suffered dementia from years of alcoholism. The second Christ was Joseph. He was a little younger than Clyde and used to be a writer before falling into a delusional state, believing that he was British and needed to go back to England to serve the Queen. The third Christ was the saddest case. Leon was in his 30s and was very coherent and well-spoken, but he had been raised by a severely religious schizophrenic woman and now believed that he was God and that he had magical powers. Of all the Christs, Leon was the most regal. He even looked like paintings of Jesus. Dr. Rokic uprooted these men from the environments they knew, put them all in the same ward, and insisted that they have daily meetings together to talk about being Christ. Needless to say, they did not get along. They spat and ranted and argued, each Christ fighting desperately to assert his role as king. The grad students, Ron and Dick, monitored and recorded the three Christ behavior for 11 hours a day, every day, while Rokic came in for the group meeting once a week.
He would lead the discussion. He would ask questions, something like, how do you think so-and-so would feel about that? He was trying to get them to think about their beliefs and change their beliefs. And Leon said he was trying to brainwash us.
But somehow, amongst all the shouting,
they did become friends. They began to share a certain familiarity with each other.
They sat together in the ward during their free time, lent each other rolling papers, stuck up for each other against other patients, and they even humored each other's delusions.
It's like when I was a child and I would see all these different Santa Clauses, right? And but there was only supposed to be one Santa Claus. But then my parents resolved that by saying, well, there's one true Santa Claus, but then all these others that you see are just helpers. And they kind of handled that in the same way, that they were the true God or Christ, and these others were, Leon's terms were, instrumental gods.
It's not like any of them stopped believing that they were God, but they turned the other cheek and kept their beliefs to themselves, because they wanted to give the others a chance to believe that they were God too. Which was shocking to Rokic, because he believed that schizophrenics were unable to empathize with others. That fact wasn't shocking to Dick and Ron, the grad students. They'd always known the three Christs had feelings. They spent so much time with them, they couldn't help but get close to them. Dick's favorite Christ was Clyde.
But every once in a while he'd clear up and speak of the old days on the railroad and going fishing and things like that. And he was a great raconteur, very warm.
And Ron liked Joseph the best.
Often he would want me to take him to a small store, and he would buy a can of baked beans and open it up and eat that, and he loved that. And we would talk about books because he was a great reader, and He would pick up magazines and books and then throw them out windows when he thought people weren't looking.
Why?
Why any of that? I have no idea. In my belief system, it did not make sense.
But Ron tried to make sense of it anyway. The grad students tried to be empathetic with the Christs in order to communicate with them. They didn't expect that befriending the mentally ill would start to blur their own realities.
In fact, we used to often play with letting ourselves slide into a paranoid frame of reference and just see who could last the longest before he became so anxious he had to get out. I think it was a way, probably, of working through the fear that we encountered at Ypsilanti. But you can make anything into a source of paranoia. I'm sitting here in a studio, which is a perfect place to be paranoid. You've got microphones and all sorts of gadgets, you know, looking at you. You can wonder about who placed them there, who really placed them there, who really placed them there, and go on and on with this endlessly.
The grad students began to resent Rokic. Here they were, questioning their sanity in an asylum, and there he was, behind a desk at the university.
We got so angry at Milt, and it was that he was getting all the gravy and we were in here doing all the suffering. He was a smart guy, but he wasn't there.
And whenever Rokic did show up, he pestered the patients with such a strong line of questioning, pressuring them to admit that each of them was the one and only Christ. This just confused the patients, and they began to backslide and squabble against each other again.
I can only imagine the anger they must have felt towards Rokic. He always represented, I think, power, a lot of power.
We did believe that he was behaving too confrontational.
So Ron and Dick confronted him about it.
I guess it was our feeling of being protective of these guys.
He was a very cerebral person. He just disagreed, and that was it.
Ron and Dick eventually left the study to complete their programs. And that's when Rokic's tactics got even more extreme. A journalist covered the story of the three Christs in the local paper. The writer was not kind to the Christs and poked fun at their situation. Rokic brought in the article and showed it to the men. Clyde didn't understand it. Joseph didn't even realize the article was about him. He said the men in the article were nuts. Only Leon understood. He began yelling, saying that he had been betrayed and that his feelings were hurt. Leon's reaction intrigued Rokic. His next plan was to create a positive authority figure for Leon. He hired a beautiful woman, Miss Anderson, to be his next research assistant. He basically had Miss Anderson flirt with Leon, trying to get him to fall in love with her. He thought that Leon would be able to choose to leave behind his schizophrenia in order to be with her. And Leon did fall in love with her.
He was still reachable beneath that intense delusional system because he showed wishes to connect with people, like with the young woman research assistant. But unfortunately, it was just a tease.
Because Miss Anderson would never really be with Leon. And Leon wasn't stupid. He soon figured that out. That she didn't really love him, and she never would. And so he withdrew even further, saying, "Truth is my friend. I have no other friends."
Using deception and entrapment to tap into where he had strong feelings was cruel. The recollection of it still moves me very painfully. I think so much more could have been done with him. If he had had more real psychological treatment at that point, he could have been helped.
The study wound up lasting 2 years. Afterward, Milton Rokic published the successful book, The Three Christs of Ypsilanti. In it, he admitted that none of the three Christs were cured of their schizophrenic delusions. However, the study did cure a fourth Christ. 20 years after the study, Milton Rokic wrote an afterword to his book. Here's an excerpt.
"I must confess that I now almost regret having written and published The Three Christs of Ypsilanti when I did. While I failed to cure the three Christs of their delusions, they succeeded in curing me of mine, of my godlike delusion that I could change them by omnipotently rearranging their daily lives. I found out from my teachers, the three Christs of Ypsilanti, exactly in what sense they were trying to be godlike. They were striving for goodness and greatness. And such strivings, I came to understand, are really the strivings of all of us.
Big thanks to Richard Bonnier and Ronald Hopp for their help in the story. We owe a big debt as well to Milton Rokic's book, The Three Christs of Ypsilanti. We'll have a link on our website, snapjudgment.org. That piece was produced by Snap Judgment's own Stephanie Fu. You're listening to Snap Judgment, The Crown. And the good news is there is more where that came from. Snap will be right back in a moment. Stay tuned. Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR, The Crown episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and today we're bringing you stories about regular people, the salt of the earth, bumping up against the highest class of all, royalty. So, I had just gotten a brand new job working for the American Embassy in Malaysia, right? And when I first walked off the plane in Kuala Lumpur, I got kind of nervous because there's a huge banner that reads, "Anyone possessing illegal drugs will be killed." Well, thankfully, I didn't have any of those. A driver actually meets me at the gate, takes me to this palatial home, and tells me this is where I was going to live. A beautiful lady comes out and says she's the maid and to just ask if I need anything at all. And you know, I'm from the Midwest, so this is awesome. I go for a little walk and discover that my new home sits next door to a house with a sign reading North Korean Embassy. North Korea. And when you think of North Korean officials, you might picture unsmiling folk dressed in 70s-style pantsuits like Kim Jong-il and nuclear weapons and all that stuff. But nothing could be further from the case for these fellas. Only personal friends of the dictator get let out of North Korea for diplomatic missions. And an assignment like Malaysia was like a get-out-of-jail-free card, and they played it. North Korean royalty. They had the BMWs, the fat sunglasses, the white smiles, the pinstripe suits, and the shiny shoes. And every night, right next door to me, they had a party, a blowout, with the ladies and the laugh and the shouting, all kinds of noise, blaring techno music till 4 in the morning, right when I'm trying to get some shut-eye. Quiet down! Sure, I could pretend that I was upset over their lack of neighborly consideration. But the real problem, what really burned me up, was that nobody ever invited me over for their good time games. Sometimes I kind of wander near the house, you know, but then these big guards would come out and make sure I kept a stepping. And it became kind of an obsession. I had to get in. And one night I figured that if I couldn't go in the front door, maybe I could try the back. I went to my backyard next to their backyard, and that's when I saw her. An Australian woman I kinda knew,
She spoke in a low voice to a North Korean man. She handed him something, and he handed her something. Drug deals look the same no matter where you are. Then he looked over, and he saw me seeing him, and there was just this anger. Not like he was mad at me. He was just mad. Mad that I had seen the dirty laundry. And when the woman left the house, I caught up with her. What's going on? She told me. She didn't care. See, North Korea was out of hard currency. So the Home Office told every foreign mission they had to pay their own way. And diplomats are allowed to take diplomatic pouches inside foreign countries without passing through customs. Normally, this is how you bring in documents and spy stuff and such. But the North Koreans, royalty or no, they had to make money. So they filled diplomatic pouches with illegal narcotics, marched right by customs, and sold their wares on embassy grounds like two-bit drug dealers. Even if they got caught, diplomatic immunity. And if they didn't play the game, bad things could happen to their families. Very bad things. I stopped trying to get invitations to their parties, and I wore earplugs every night to block out the techno music. Snappers, there are many different crowns that one can wear. For our next story, we're taking you to the plains of Oklahoma to meet a little girl named Susan Supernaw, who was raised in the Muscogee Creek and Munsee American Indian tribes.
It's always been important to Indian people that they have a special name, and it's given to them in a variety of different ways. In our way, it is a name that the spirits will know you by. A lot of tribes name the child when they are born. Some tribes, they wait till the child has dreams and they name the child. But for me, it was different from both of those. Growing up on a farm, we had a couple of plow horses, so I would go out riding with my sister. And we'd race across these fields and we'd play games where I would track her down. We're doing one of these and I saw her in the distance, and so I was going to run up and try to catch her. And so I rode the horse and I was urging her, go, come on, come on. And we're running across this open field. And the horse stepped in a rabbit hole. I was riding bareback and I just reached down and put my arms around her neck. She started to fall. And she flipped over, and I pressed my head against her neck, gripped my feet around her body as tight as I could. She came down right on top of me. At first, when I blacked out, I saw everything got really foggy, and kind of out of the fog came this beautiful Indian woman. Her hair was kind of long, and it flowed free. She was carrying this little bear cub, very sickly-looking bear cub in her hand. The lady sat down and she kind of blessed it, and then it got up and started dancing and spinning around and jumping up in the air. And she also gave me my Indian name, which she said would be Eliapona. And that, I found out later, meant dancing feet. She told me that I was the bear cub, and that in order to earn my name, then I had to dance in the way that this bear cub did. I woke up in the hospital, and I was out for about 3 or 4 days. I was paralyzed from the waist down, and they just said, well, you're lucky to be alive. That just seemed unusually cruel that the spirits would name a child dancing feet and have them not be able to move. I can't even walk. I can't even get up out of this bed. That seemed like an impossible task. And so that's kind of what started my whole journey. And the bear cub became my totem then, and the beautiful lady became my spirit guide. My first goal was to walk and to just try to be normal. I learned to walk very slowly, from just taking a few steps to taking walks. And then after I could do that, then I started wanting to do more. When all the doctors were saying, just be thankful to walk, just leave it. I gotta dance. It was a promise I made to myself as well as to the spirits. If I could use my feet again, I would earn my name. That's kind of how it all started happening. The very first pageant I ever entered was the Miss Phillips University pageant in Enid, Oklahoma. When I was standing on stage with the last two people, I just never imagined I'd win. So I had started to walk forward, thinking that, you know, I'm the first runner-up. And the girl actually kind of grabbed my dress in the back and says, wait, that's me. And I ended up winning the pageant, to the surprise of just about everybody, probably except the judges. I only realized after I had gotten into the Miss Oklahoma pageant that this might just be a way to earn my name. And I went and I started training, working out, borrowed clothes from my roommate, and managed to eke my way through the pageant.
Ladies and gentlemen, your new Miss Oklahoma is...
I was lucky, very, very lucky, in that somehow I managed to win the Miss Oklahoma pageant the first time I was in it. If I had just lost, it would have been fine with me. But the fact that I didn't lose told me, I'm just going to say it, God had a plan for me, or the spirits had a plan for me. I don't want to get too weird on you. And so that's kind of what led up to the Miss America pageant. I sometimes thought that I certainly maybe didn't belong there, but I thought it must have been some kind of learning experience. I heard lots of side comments. There shouldn't be an Indian in the pageant. He's the most prominent one. They had press conferences where people come up and ask you to pose for pictures. And so when my turn came up, they asked me if I would give them a war cry. And then I was like, well, I don't feel comfortable doing that. Well, then the pageant personnel, well, you're supposed to cooperate with them, so we'll do what they ask. I put my hand over my mouth because that's how the women do it traditionally. I let loose a lulu that scared the living daylights out of them. The headline in the newspaper below the picture said war cry, and it said I wanted the Miss America scalp. I was crushed. I didn't know if I could do it or not. When I was performing, I got a feeling that my spirit guide was with me, and when they were applauding, I remember looking and seeing her standing there with the little bear cup, and they turned and kind of walked off, and I thought that was a very good sign. Before I went to the Miss America pageant, I had this private meeting with the Indian elders. They felt that it was more important for me to get out there and do what I needed to do, which was to dance, to earn my name, than it was to win the pageant. But again, when it's your name, I can't go to my elders and say, hey, I saw this, I earned my name. No, the elders come to you and tell you if you earned your name. I didn't tell them a thing of what I saw. In a teepee in a backyard in Oklahoma is where I got my name. I met with my mentor, Kenneth Ankew, and he just said, it's time for you to go to your meeting. During this meeting was when he was feathering me off with the smoke, that he called me by my name, Eliopona, and asked the spirits to recognize me. And it was wonderful. I just felt like a tingling through my whole body. You know, you sit back down, but you're just shaking, and it just changed my life after that. I just felt like I had finally done something that really meant something personal to me, and I felt complete.
Thanks to Susan Supernaw for sharing her story, and you can find out more about her world on our website, snapjudgment.org. The piece was produced by Anna Sussman, with additional sound design by Renzo Gorio. Uh-oh, it's about that time. Because time flies when you're having some snap. And you think, Glenn, what am I to do? I think I missed part of the show. Well, not to worry. By royal edict, we've made full episodes, movie stuff, available for you right now on our website, snapjudgment.org. Facebook? Yeah. Snap Judgment's on Facebook. What is wrong with you? Why are you not my Facebook friend? Twitter, snapjudgment.org. iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, NPR app, your mama's house, the internet, it's everywhere. Just like love. Snap Judgment was produced by myself and Her Majesty's Royal Guild of Bardmaster Popinjays. May I introduce the man at arms himself, the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. He tastes the beats before allowing you to. Pat Macedi Miller. Stephanie Fu only drinks from a jeweled goblet. Anna Sussman's veins run with blue blood. Renzo Gorio challenges you to a duel. Julia DeWitt wears overalls at court. Nick Vanderkolk sells no wine before it's time. And if you look closely, you'll see that Will Urbina wears a crown underneath his hoodie. Now, just because we sent them a letter declaring they'd been renamed the Hip Hop Hood Hats by order of Her Majesty the Duchess of York, we didn't think they'd really change the stationery so quickly. And Snap Judgment apologizes for any confusion. We need thanks to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, locking the public in the royal dungeons until the public tells us exactly what we need to know. PRX.org. You Speaks, because the next generation can speak for itself. YouSpeaks.org. And you know, this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you can move some old stuff around in the basement, come across an ancient genealogy that unmistakably places you and not Prince Charles as next in line for the British crown, then you could burn all proof of your lineage and you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.